Next case and last case. Dillon versus Seattle. Deposition report.
Is it the same lawyers?
No, different lawyers, Mr. Cromwell. But I am the appellant in this case.
We'll wait for the switch then.
Sure.
Hard to tell who's waiting around, having argued before, and who's still yet to go.
Sorry. Sorry about that.
Well, let me thank you. It's been a fun day watching this. It's a little more exciting than other days down here.
That's interesting issue.
Yeah. It's a hard one. All right. Let me begin. But I'm going to pick up on that last...
just where we are on the record so you can be identified.
Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah, Dennis Moran representing Mr. Dillon in this case.
And how much time do you want to reserve?
6 and 4, please. Six first and four reserved. Thank you. All right. Should parties have to endure litigation? Well, let me suggest that if lawyers are going to practice secretly recording witness interviews without telling them, winding them up, and then having them call in, lie to them, get them to talk, and if that's going to be the practice in this state, yeah, they're going to have to endure litigation because we have a statute that says it's illegal.
But the gravamen, really, for SLAPP purposes is the filing. Isn't that right?
This is, okay, this is a different case. This is a case. Mr. Dillon was not in the other lawsuit. Mr. Dillon did not sue T-Mobile. He sued the individuals who sat in that room and who set him up and made the recording, and those were the lawyers and the court reporter. This has nothing to do with the filing. The complaint in this case is very, very narrow. It doesn't complain about what anyone did with the transcript. What it says is, Mr. Dillon says, you illegally recorded a conversation that I had that was private with you and you didn't have my consent, period, end of story. Whatever you did with it after that is outside the complaint. The defense is they keep trying to draw the after stuff into this and turn it into a SLAPP case. And I'm going to suggest that's not the I mean, they're trying to redo the gravamen of the complaint, and if you allow that, what you're doing is you're turning every single instance of lawyer misconduct into a SLAPP-protected thing to do, because everything we do has something to do with the law.
Let me take it back to where we were about 90 minutes ago. The case comes for decision before the trial court. How is the trial court to view the facts? Is the trial court a fact finder? Is it a 12B6 standard? Is it a CR56 standard? Talking about our standard review here. I'm talking about how is the trial court to deal with factual averments, and especially factual averments that are in contest with one another?
Thank you for asking that, because I remember I've been thinking about that since you asked that in the prior case. Here's how it has to do it. The SLAPP statute itself has to be constitutional, which means it has to comply procedurally with other procedures that are deemed constitutional. Summary judgment has been challenged for being unconstitutional. A whole bunch of case law on it. And it survives constitutional scrutiny, the process, only because there is a period of discovery where people can develop facts, and then it goes in front of the court, and only when there are no undisputed material facts is it ripe. And that is the only way you get by constitutional scrutiny the right to jury trial. Okay, that's it. So if you do anything less than that, if a statute says you can resolve a case anything short of that, you're running afoul of the right to jury trial. Simple. The SLAPP statute says, note this thing up, if it's on a certain topic, you're into court with no discovery, no evidence, no witnesses, nothing, and you have the burden to prove your claim by clear and convincing evidence, which is absolutely impossible. Okay, it's an unconstitutional statute from that standpoint. Now, I gave it a lot of thought because I had argued in my pleadings, admittedly, that it should be a summary judgment standard. I was wrong. It should be a 12B6 standard because the SLAPP statute itself says no discovery unless discovery is allowed, whereas at least the summary judgment statute says you get discovery before having the motion, and if you think you don't have enough discovery, you file a 56F motion to go get some more, and only when the case has been developed and only when it's factually ripe for summary judgment can the court rule on it as a matter of law, and only when that procedure is followed does summary judgment survive constitutional scrutiny.
Judgment on the pleadings type of action, in other words, you can convert it to a summary judgment if you consider matters outside the actual pleading.
Yes, yes. So this is, and this is what I'm saying. What you've got in the SLAPP statute is essentially a 12B6. I mean, you're...
Well, isn't it a bit of a hybrid?
It is a bit of a hybrid. I guess it depends on how you stage it. For example,
doesn't it depend on whether you submit factual assertions and affidavits and declarations? Doesn't that convert it to a CR 56 motion?
Well, absolutely, it does. If you're relying in any manner on an affidavit or fact, anything outside the pleadings.
It's not purely a judgment on the pleadings, then.
The SLAPP.
Right.
It is. You're right. You're correct. It's not a judgment on the pleadings thing. But what I'm saying is it must be, because if you're going to use facts, you have to use the summary judgment mechanism to survive constitutional scrutiny, the right to jury trial, which means you got to go through the process. 12B6 survives constitutional scrutiny because it's just about pleading claims. There's no factual issues to resolve. The instant you throw a fact in, okay, you're outside of 12B6, and the instant that fact is disputed, it's got to go to a jury, unless it's a maritime case.
Judge
it's got Heller, to go to a jury.
Judge Heller started off with a summary judgment, though.
Yeah, he reversed the whole process.
Well, doesn't 5C allow him to do that? It says on motion.
Well,
it doesn't say on the party's motion.
It says you
for
can,
good
yeah.
cause shown.
No. It says you can hear other motions. It doesn't say you can reverse the order of the SLAPP motion itself.
Of course itself. It doesn't say that, but can't yeah. that be fairly read mm-hmm. as allowing the court on its own motion for good cause shown? It doesn't say on the party's motion, if you look at the statute.
Sure, I understand what you're saying. Here's the problem with that, and here's the problem with what Judge Heller did. Judge Heller started from the presence. He says, look, if it's lawful conduct and it's related to petition, and he got petition wrong, by the way. That's my time.
We'll see you again in 10 minutes.
All right.
Good morning.
Good morning.
I'm Ralph Cromwell. I represent the defendants. Given all of the argument about the SLAPP statute and how it works, I think I want to back up a step and try to be really clear about what we did here. This was, as he mentioned, a very narrow lawsuit. It was a single claim. It was RCW 973, an illegal recording. And rather than answer, we moved for summary judgment, classic Rule 56 summary judgment motion on a single issue. Is this a private conversation? The 973 only applies to private conversations. So this is a classic summary judgment motion on a single issue. What's our undisputed evidence? We have two basic pieces of undisputed evidence. We have the transcript of, or the recording, if you will, of the discussion at issue. And we have the sworn testimony of the plaintiff in front of Judge Martinez, where the fight first arose about, well, how did you get this transcript and what was said and were you telling the truth? So what did our undisputed evidence say about this single issue of was this a private conversation? And the Supreme Court says private means secret, confidential, just between you and I. Well, first there's the context. The plaintiff, Mr. Dillon, was a vice president and a key witness for the plaintiff in the federal lawsuit, and he voluntarily contacts opposing counsel and says, I've resigned. I want to tell you something that
okay,
will be...
Okay, so is this... So you're, on the underlying question, your position is we apply a summary judgment. The trial court applies a summary judgment standard.
Yes. And,
okay.
And,
let me ask you this question. The California statute says that it exists to vindicate rights under both the United States Constitution and the California Constitution. Washington statute does not say that. When the Washington statute refers to the constitutional right of petition, can it be referring to anything other than Article 1, Section 4 of the Washington Constitution? In other words, if it's only talking about one right, if the rights are not coterminous, if they provide for different things, need we conclude that the Washington legislature was legislating about the Washington Constitution to the exclusion of the federal Constitution rather than that it was legislating about the federal Constitution to the exclusion of the Washington Constitution?
I'll be honest with you and say we didn't brief that. I've always assumed that it was either Constitution.
And it says the. We spent a lot of time in the briefing today where people are arguing about the word shall or the word and. Any number of individual words in a statute. I'm looking at the word the.
Our theory of petition was very simple.
Your theory of petition was that you were involved in a lawsuit and that you had a right to be involved in a lawsuit under the First Amendment. Under Article 1, Section 4 of the Washington Constitution, it does not involve, it is purely a political right, and it does not involve access to the courts. So if this is a state constitution that's being referred to, where do you find your constitutional right that's being infringed by his actions?
The statute itself clearly refers to the judicial branch as being one of the branches of government.
And it does. And it also, in sections A and B of that five-part multi-choice for where you can find the public activity or whatever it is, A refers to judicial proceedings. B refers to judicial proceedings. You rest your claim on E, which talks about the right to partition, the right to petition. So it seems that the legislature was clearly able to legislate with regard to judicial proceedings in the same subsection of the statute. And then it referred to the constitutional right to petition, which I aver refers to the Washington Constitution, which does not refer to judicial proceedings.
Well, I would point out, to start with, Your Honor, the word includes. What this statute covers is public participation and petition. The five small A through E are not the extent of the statute. They are simply things that the statute includes. And our theory was very...
So, hold it a second. So you want us to construe this as having other freestanding matters that can come within its ambit when we're balancing constitutional rights, so there's no notice to the other party. The scope of this is without notice to the other party, even though it's impinging on the other party's constitutional rights.
We know
the other party has a First Amendment right under the petition clause to access the courts. So there's a standardless, a formless number of things that can be added?
You have the standard that it has to involve public participation or petition. That's not standardless. That's as clear as, negligence. You know, where's the notice? Where's the standard? There's a lot of standards in law that aren't spelled out black and white. But clearly what the statute says is we want to encourage people to petition the government and to participate in government. Our theory was very simple. We got sued because we blew the whistle. We went to a branch of government, the federal branch.
Well, you got sued because you caused a recording to take place that is alleged was not lawful to be recorded. That's the gravamen of the opposing parties.
And the whole point of making the recording was to then give it to Judge Martinez.
Which is why you need the in connection with language under E. But if judicial proceedings are referred to in A, and judicial proceedings are referred to in B, and judicial proceedings are not referred to in E, but rather the constitutional right of petition is referred to, and if that refers to the state constitution, then it appears you have no claim.
Perhaps no slap claim.
On a slap claim, which is what we're here about.
I don't think, I will back up and say, first of all, I don't think this was argued below.
No, but we're being asked to construe statutes, and we've been asked to do it all day. And so we're not only worried about the four or five that came before, we're worried about the 16 in the pipeline, too. There's a reason that we're putting all of these things one day so everybody can hear each other and we can engage in joint education.
I appreciate that, and obviously you've thought about this very carefully, but I mention it for two reasons, which is, one, primarily I'm here about my lawsuit. And when I say none of this was argued before, it's none of this has been developed in the record. This was not argued to the court.
Well, the Washington Constitution either does or does not provide the same thing as the First Amendment. I mean, that's not a fact question. I'm contending that I don't think it does. This is your opportunity to disabuse me of that notion.
I've always believed when it referred to the Constitution, it could be either Constitution, the federal Constitution or the state Constitution, and that what the state legislature was trying to do is say to the citizens of Washington that if you want to participate in government, if you want to exercise your Constitution.
We've got all of this writing about everybody knew about California's law, and it was modeled after California's law, but they made changes. They didn't adopt this, or they didn't adopt that. They made a Washington legislature made a higher burden of proof on the non-moving party by clear and convincing evidence. All of these intelligent decisions that were made by the legislature. And then one of the things they did not do was say both the United States Constitution and the Washington Constitution, even though California legislature had said both the United States Constitution and the California Constitution. When we're looking at all of these other things and we're supposed to assign meaning to it, why shouldn't I assign meaning to that?
Perhaps you should assign meaning to it, Your Honor, but all I can say in this case is that was not argued. It was not presented below. It is not an issue presented here on appeal. And so you have me at a disadvantage having never had the issue raised. We haven't briefed it. I think
it was front and center. You had to show at the inception that you were engaged in an action that fell within A through E. You claim E. It's teed up.
We claim A, B, and E. And I would, the argument was.
I mean, I'm not importing E into this, so I stumbled across this because you told me to read it. And I stumbled across California because you guys told me to look at that.
Our argument in our brief was A, B, and E. And we did not limit ourselves to E. And I think clearly, the argument made is not that you don't have a constitutional right. The argument made is we narrowly limited our lawsuit so that we weren't actually suing you for reporting it to the court, because that's what Judge Andrus got us for. Our only argument was they're conceding that that's the right of petition. The word is in furtherance of. It's not limited to the right of petition. As long as it's in furtherance of, it's within the statute. And it was never argued that this is not within the constitutional right of petition. Thank you.
Okay, Mr. Moran, you're on.
Back to your question. Okay, I'm not going to argue about the reversal of the order, but let me just address whether the case should have survived under a summary judgment standard. The answer is clearly no. If this was just a summary judgment motion, there is no way this thing makes it by. For the first reason is we had filed a motion for 56F to get additional discovery, which under the summary judgment we'd be entitled to do, and that would be presumably protected constitutionally as part of the 56 process. Second, we laid out in detail in our brief.
But that was denied.
That was denied, correct.
Okay, and that's not one of the issues that we're reviewing on appeal. So kind of target gone by.
Correct. I'm just talking about the scope of summary judgment. All right. The hearing in federal court was not the hearing in state court at summary judgment. Two entirely different animals. Dillon wasn't even a party in federal court. It was an evidentiary hearing that was truncated. Judge Heller was listening to a summary judgment argument, and it was conceded that that's the standard. And let's look at the evidence he had, because if the evidence, if there was evidence before.
Yeah. We've got a difference. When Judge Martinez was making his decision, those were facts that never would go to a jury. He was the decision maker to determine what the facts were in order to determine whether he would impose sanctions up to and including dismissal. So that the whole purpose of that hearing was for him to make his decision. That isn't that different from just the slap motion.
What Judge Martinez did was entirely different, because he did two things. The first thing he had to do was to make an evidentiary determination as to whether the transcript was even admissible. And if it's not admissible, it can't even be considered on his other motion, the other part of it, which was this spoliation motion. You're starting to slip down a collateral estoppel issue. We briefed, and the elements just aren't there. I mean, however you get at it, there's no identity of parties and there's no identity of issues, and the standard is different because it was an evidentiary standard rather than a summary judgment standard. But I want to come back and address the summary judgment issue, because Judge Heller, if he were properly addressing this thing on summary judgment, would have said, let me look at Mr. Dillon's declaration, okay, and let me assume that everything Mr. Dillon says is true. Okay, he's the non-moving party. And here's what Mr. Dillon says. Mr. Dillon says, I told these guys I wouldn't talk to them unless this conversation was kept private and confidential. They agreed that the conversation would be kept private and confidential. And then it goes on, and I've listed these. Any one of those facts would be sufficient to push this to a jury where a jury could find.
Says, yeah. Dillon said the same thing to Judge Martinez, and Judge Martinez said he was lying.
It's a
so
different.
What does that operate as some sort of a bill of attainder, such that it follows him to future litigation, and no. So the trial court can't believe him either because Judge Martinez didn't believe him?
I'm going to not chase the bill of attainder thing, but let me say why that's wrong. Look, if Judge Heller would have said, "I don't believe Dillon is telling the truth," and then granted summary judgment against Dillon, that would be an error as a matter of law on summary judgment. So what you're postulating is if another judge in another case does exactly the same thing, says, I don't believe Dillon, that act, something that wouldn't even work in Dillon's own court, somehow knocks him out of the box. And no, absolutely not. I mean, that's that. There are, we've identified 12 issues, I think I did them sequentially, that any one of which would have given a jury plenty of reason to reasonably infer that the conversation was private. And the whether it's private was a question of fact that was for a jury to determine, regardless of what Judge Martinez did in another case. And this should have survived summary judgment. But I still think the 12B6 is more appropriate for SLAPP. Okay. So.
Thank you very much, everyone. Appreciate your arguments. Are we done?
Unless you got another one for me.
All right. Court is in recess.